From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you, thank you, thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
There's two separate pieces that we have to be doing, right? There's that outward-facing work of showing up as an ally for folks who are more vulnerable as often as possible and as effectively as possible. And there is the inner work, right? There is that work of being soft and juicy and tender on the inside. And I'm going to try my best not to let the government, of all things, steal that part. Me.
It's easy to get overwhelmed at the intersection of religion, government, and politics these days. We've often drawn clarity from the analysis of author, activist, and attorney Rabbi Jay Michelson. On this week's show, we'll delve into the other journey he's been on, as chronicled in a new collection of his writing recently published in book form, titled Enlightenment by Trial and Error, 10 Years on the Slippery Slopes of Jewish Spirituality, Postmodern Buddhism, and Other Mystical Heresies.
So I've put into your hands this evening the second inaugural address. This remarkable address, the most profound address in the whole American story of the role of God in American history, of the way that we combine religion and politics. Yes, we've separated church and state, as well we should. We have never separated religion and politics.
Monday is President's Day. As we pause to remember some of the great leaders our nation has had, I want to revisit an interview we first aired in 2009, examining the careful way one of the greatest, Abraham Lincoln, occasionally used faith language in his brilliant oratory. The guest was Lincoln biographer Ronald C. White, Jr. But first,
Bernie Sanders won, but not by a lot, so it's really like third. And Pete Buttigieg was second, but who saw that coming? So it's more like first. And Amy Klobuchar was third, which is really surprising, so it's also like first. And Joe Biden came in fifth, but was expected to do better, so it's more like eighth. So I guess the real winner is Andrew Yang, because he dropped out and doesn't have to deal with this anymore. So
now that the first primary of the 2020 election cycle has passed, we can catch our breath a little bit and see where things stand. We've certainly seen a number of candidates invoke the language of faith in reaching out to supporters. But is that resonating with voters? At the same time, legislative and policy initiatives are moving forward at great speed and with far too little media attention much of the time. For a look at both what is in front of and behind the curtain, I'm happy to be joined by Rabbi Jack Moline, president of Interfaith Alliance, who is always welcome here, and I am glad that you're with us today, Jack.
I am always pleased to be with you, Will.
Were you surprised by how things played out in New Hampshire this week?
I was surprised, but then I'm notoriously bad at electoral predictions. But I really was very surprised to see Vice President Biden so far behind the pack and Senator Klobuchar make her big move. And beyond that, I kind of figured we'd shake out a couple of candidates this week.
When we look at which candidates invoked religious ideas, do you see that resonating with the electorate?
I think that voters on the left, being suspicious of the religious right, have something of a suspicion of the faith message that comes from candidates who typically don't talk about faith. So one of the reasons I think that it has resonated with voters when Mayor Buttigieg talks about his faith is because it's been part of his public persona for a long time. But it does not seem to be affecting much when people who've been in public office in a spotlight for a long time try to introduce faith issues that have not been part of their agenda.
Interfaith Alliance always keeps a close eye on the misuse of religion in our politics. This time around, have you seen lines beginning to be crossed that cause concern for you?
Well, once again, it depends on what side of the partisan divide we're talking about. There have certainly been some momentary lapses of good sense when it comes to talking about faith among the candidates who are vying for the Democratic presidential nomination. I have not seen anybody double down on the kind of rhetoric of, if you subscribe to a particular kind of faith, then you have to vote for me because that's my faith too. I haven't seen any of that. We haven't seen any of that. And in fact, we have not found a lot in the debates and the public presentations by the candidates that have crossed that line. Where we've seen it, we've spoken out. On the other side of the partisan divide, Welton, I see nothing but a breach of the separation between religion and government. We saw last week the National Prayer Breakfast, which is a private partisan event that has attained a sort of semi-governmental status because it attracts so many elected officials. And the President of the United States, who when he says something is never not the President of the United States, crossed that line so many times, I got writer's cramp.
Mm-hmm. So does Interfaith Alliance address that?
It is one of the major items that we focus on in our function as a watchdog on religious freedom issues in government. We have flagged so many times these violations over the past 3 years, and will continue to do so. We make every effort to be fair and nonpartisan as we examine these things. We're just seeing an awful lot going on one side of the aisle that is not going on the other side of the aisle. And it's not just the political language that's being used or the use of religion to sort of gin up the base in a campaign. We're also seeing it applied in policy matters, which is of much greater concern because it affects more people more directly.
The Alliance provides resources to help voters sort through the rhetoric to make sure their vote aligns with their values. And I wish you would talk about those resources in the context of this year's campaigns.
So we have perpetually guides for voters and guides for campaigners, not on specific policy issues, but on what constitutional principles to focus on when evaluating candidates. And those are on our website, interfaithalliance.org. And I would encourage any of the listeners who are interested to go there and just look for election year materials. We update them constantly. They are vetted by our crackerjack attorneys who keep an eye on the changing laws surrounding public expression of faith issues. And we have in the past distributed, and I have no reason to imagine we would not do the same for the general election, we've distributed cards with 5 questions to ask candidates. And what we suggest are the constitutionally appropriate answers to those questions when they are talking about faith on the campaign trail. So we have those resources. We also provide updated guides to houses of worship on what is appropriate and inappropriate engagement in a political season. and guides for candidates as well. Although I will tell you, we have fewer requests for that than for the other two items.
And I wondered if it's too early in the race yet to even begin talking to the candidates about the crossroads of religion and politics.
But we're not waiting for them to call us. We have been in touch for 6 months or more with announced candidates as they've come online to suggest that we're available to consult with them and to offer them guidance. We've had some appreciative responses, but so far no invitations.
There's a lot of policy being made without much public attention. Where is Interfaith Alliance focusing its energies here?
So there are three legislative initiatives that our policy advisor, Katie Joseph, is most focused on. The first is Every Child Deserves a Family, which is designed to prevent the agencies that deal with foster care and adoption from discriminating on the basis of the religious faith and the sexual orientation of the people who would like to give a forever home to a child without one. The second is the No Ban Act, where we've stood steadfastly with our coalition partners, particularly those in the Muslim community who've taken the lead on this, to make sure that there will not be another ban against people on the basis of their religion, their ethnic origin, or their nationality without considering them individually. And the third is the Equality Act, which makes sure that the protections of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, though they have been abused and weaponized by the religious right, we want to make sure that the language includes protections against discrimination that are directed at the LGBTQ plus community. So those are the three legislative initiatives we've been working on. All three of those bills will pass the House, and then the battle will become whether they will even get a hearing in the Senate. But if they pass the House in this session of Congress, and the House is similarly constituted in the next session of Congress, then depending on what the Senate looks like, there may be an opportunity for some of these progressive civil rights bills to find their way into law.
I have always said that there is no election worth winning at the cost of compromising religious liberty and other parts of our Constitution. We depend on our Constitution and leaders whose job is to assure justice in so much of religious freedom concerns. And now we have worries in the government in a place where we wouldn't have thought we would have it. We have some scary things going on in the Justice Department, and we see some slack in justice taking place because of the president wanting something to be done that he wants done. I fear that because if that goes on, everything we're about becomes vulnerable. Would you just talk about that for a minute?
I sure will. I want to say two things about that. Well, the first is this. You know, here at Interfaith Alliance, we have always taken a very inclusive approach to what constitutes faith. For some people, it is something theistic or grounded in a religious tradition that goes back centuries, if not longer. And for some people, there's a moral compass on which they rely that is more internally located. We consider both of those things matters of conscience that are protected by the First Amendment. Nobody in this country should allow whatever that moral guidance is on which they rely to supersede the rule of law. That's what our more perfect union is all about, a constitution that applies equally to everybody. I cannot tell you, because I've never met the man, whether President Trump is a faithful adherent of a particular faith tradition or whether he finds his moral compass inside of him. But when he uses his preferences or his inclinations or his sense of personal umbrage to circumvent the law, I think he's violating the Constitution. Now, you won't hear me advocating for another impeachment hearing, but I am saying it's something we all ought to be very, very wary of. So that's the first thing I want to say. The second thing is, the president's Twitter tantrums are not necessarily the most dangerous things for us to attend to. Almost every agency in the government, almost every cabinet position in the government is in the midst of evaluating new guidelines that empower people to discriminate on the basis of their own personal religious beliefs. And this is happening not without notice by us and by our allies, but it's happening without notice by most of the people in the United States because they're too busy watching the spectacles of the campaigning that are going on. And they're not understanding that this is going to affect everything from school lunches and instructional standards in the classroom and where their tax dollars go to support education, to what kind of medical treatment is available to them, legal medical treatment, if the provider decides that it's not something that he or she wants to participate in, to the safety of the food that they eat. And these things are all happening virtually without comment in the public because they don't contain obscenities or they're not calling someone else a name.
Jack, big picture, do you have a sense that the country is tuned in to what's going on in the nation's capital day in and day out? And that includes the impeachment trial that we just endured.
I don't think, Welton, that the nation's capital is focused in on what's happening in the nation's capital. There is such fatigue right now. And there is no excitement that has been generated by either side outside of the campaign issues. There are a lot of important people in the nation's capital, elected and non-elected, who have very, very important things to say about what's going on in our country these days. And they're just not getting traction. Our listeners can look at the op-ed pages of their local newspapers. There will be a lot of local issues discussed, as there rightly should be, but the national issues are all circulating around whether President Trump is suitable for office, pro and con. And the issues that we need to debate as a nation, those dealing with religious freedom and those beyond religious freedom, are receiving the short shrift.
Do you believe our media is up to the task of keeping the electorate well-informed as we move through this election?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have never met a reporter for a reputable news outlet who isn't both professional in his or her job or without the integrity of the journalistic endeavor. But newspapers are no longer causes. They're businesses now. And not everything gets the support it needs from the corporate office to have the kind of presentation that it needs to have. The days of independent outlets like this show, for example, which allows for wide-ranging discussions of all sorts of issues without a concern about a bottom line or an advertiser, those days are gone. And the proliferation of information outlets, both in the broadcast media and on the internet, provides, on the one hand, more information, but less orientation on the other hand, which means it's harder for people to evaluate what's going on. So the individual journalists are extraordinary at doing their jobs, just like I'll tell you, individual legislators that I know are mostly extraordinary at doing their jobs. But how that information gets to the public, that's a different story.
Jack, I can honestly say to you, never before have I been more grateful for the Interfaith Alliance. And I am so glad that you are there and a very competent staff is there, willing and eager to see to it that the most precious values in our nation are being taken care of and being protected, as well as they try to help people understand how important all of this is. Now, having said that, I want you to tell our listeners how they can support the work of Interfaith Alliance in this critically important time.
Well, I'm very flattered by your words and very grateful for them, because my respect, our respect here at Interfaith Alliance for you and the work you did is so profound. It's not the first time you've said that. And the only part that worries me is that the reason you are more and more grateful for what we do is because what we do is more and more necessary. And that is exactly the opposite of what we hope would happen. But that's all the more reason why the people listening to the broadcast and those people who are in their social circles need to turn to Interfaith Alliance to amplify their voices on the importance of the First Amendment. They can do so by contributing to Interfaith Alliance. Simple enough to do to go to interfaithalliance.org and click on donate, or by finding our address there and sending us a check. They can do so by ensuring that their values will live beyond their time on this mortal coil by considering a bequest to Interfaith Alliance, and we stand ready to help them with that. And they can do that by telling their friends and neighbors to listen to this radio program, to visit our website, and to make our first freedom their first priority.
Rabbi Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, protecting true religious freedom for all. Jack, as always, you inspire us, you instruct us, and you cause us to reaffirm our commitment to Interfaith Alliance, to state of belief, and to the religious liberty that is at the basic part of the foundation of our democracy.
Welton, I know it's been raining a lot in Louisiana. My hope is for enough sunshine to bring you a rainbow, both for its ancient biblical promise and its modern political meaning. Thanks again.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. I'll talk with Jay Michelson, author of the new book, Enlightenment by Trial and Error, 10 years of the slippery slopes of Jewish spirituality, postmodern Buddhism, and other mystical heresies. And later, we rewind to a President's Day interview from a very different time. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. Jay Michelson has often been with us talking about the Supreme Court, about LGBTQ rights, and about spiritual seeking, among other subjects. While disparate, these themes come together regularly in Jay's writing, and an invaluable guide on maintaining this balance appears in the form of his latest book titled Enlightenment by Trial and Error, 10 Years on the Slippery Slopes of Jewish Spirituality, Postmodern Buddhism, and Other Mystical Heresies. Now, for just a taste of what that encompasses, I'm happy to be joined once again by Rabbi Jay Michelson. Jay, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Welton.
You know, the title of your book would make me skeptical if I didn't know you as well as I do. We've benefited from your remarkable effectiveness as author, activist and analyst, and I've always thought your seeker nature in one realm always helps you in other realms as well. How would you characterize this complex journey in your own words?
Well, thank you for that, first of all. And I should say that just because the book has the word enlightenment in the cover doesn't mean that I'm claiming to be enlightened, far from it. The trial and error part is still continuing. You know, I think for me, these pieces really do fit together now more than ever. You know, I've for a long time now, about 10 years, I've worked in two fields. One as a meditation teacher, kind of in the spiritual world, and second as a journalist, where I write for the Daily Beast. And that's why we often talk about the Supreme Court. And it used to be that these were kind of two separate lines of my work. But certainly since 2016, I think we've all seen the intimate connection between people's, what we would call people's sense of spiritual alienation or psychological alienation, and how that manifests in politics. And that's true both on the left and on the right now, that, you know, people certainly in the primary season with the strength of Bernie Sanders, there's a deep thirst among progressives for something radically different from the status quo. And obviously we've seen it on the right in the sort of resurgent nativism, nationalism, sort of ethno-nationalism that we've seen around the world, coming from kind of deep psychological places that in some cases are really quite troubling. So for me, the two are closer now than ever before. And I think for me, spirituality without social justice is irresponsible. And social justice without some sense of higher purpose or connecting values is difficult to sustain.
Do you remember what got you started along this path?
So as I describe in the book, and actually let me mention this new book is in a way my oldest book, because it's a collection of work that I wrote early on the spiritual path. So for me, that means around 15, 20 years ago. And I put it together. You know, I always felt that this was some of my best writing on the subject of spirituality. I've written, as you know, several books since then. And yet there was something about those early essays, which were mostly published in an online magazine that I co-founded, that I just felt like it got something in a way that I think was really valuable. You know, when I was starting out with meditation and with other forms of spiritual practice, I would really have loved to have read this book. I wish I could have found a book that was somebody, you know, still with a lot of questions, not more questions than answers. And so I felt like when I relooked at those, at these old essays a couple of years ago, that there was something there. And so my editor and I took them, reordered them, re-edited them, put them into a new kind of configuration. And that kind of is what this book is, kind of a spiritual travelogue along, you know, getting pretty serious, certainly about meditation, doing a lot of long meditation retreats and integrating my Jewish upbringing and practice with my Buddhist meditation practice and other things as well. So, you know, for me, I got in for unusual reasons. I think most people, certainly in meditation, come in because they're experiencing some kind of suffering, whether it's, you know, now I teach meditation at 10% Happier, which is a leading meditation app. Most of our audience and our community are, you know, dealing with anxiety and stress and sleeplessness and self-esteem and profound fear about the way the world is headed. And I think that's probably true for, I don't know, 9 out of 10 people who take up meditation. I was number 10. I was a student of mysticism in college. And I was really interested in these profound spiritual experiences that Christian mystics reported, Jewish mystics sometimes, and certainly contemplatives from South Asian traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism, etc. And I felt like, well, here, I'm going to give it a try. It's kind of an unusual way in. But I was always sort of God intoxicated, certainly in those early years. And that's what got me on the path.
I know it's not always comfortable to have the spotlight shine on you and not just on your work, Jay, but I think it's a challenge that many, many people face. The usually false choice between single-minded pursuit of enlightenment vis-a-vis direct daily engagement with issues and communities. And it's because you've done both that I really want to hear more about that dynamics as you've made it work for yourself.
Well, thank you again. You know, one of the reasons I love coming on your show is I think this is also true for you, and I get the sense it's also true for a lot of the listeners, that whatever spiritual path we're on, whether it's a Western religious one or a contemplative one or anything else, there's that search for a kind of integration. And, you know, when we look at some of the most profound leaders for justice, let's say, in the last 100 years in America, I'm thinking obviously of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And many others. These are people who were grounded in a spiritual tradition. And, you know, again, we're coming from a progressive point of view usually, but it's also true among conservatives that some of the most effective and powerful leaders have been those who have been able to either speak their truth about faith or, in the case of our current president, co-opt the people who do. You know, for me, the two pieces really go together. I think my early work when I was doing LGBT activism, which was my work for about 10 years, was grounded in my own process of coming out and coming to terms with who I was. And for me, that was a profoundly spiritual process. A book I wrote called God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, was precisely about that point, that our shared religious values not just sort of promote tolerance or we can change them to be accepting of LGBTQ people, but actually argue strongly for values like truth and love and integrity and real compassion, which means really trying to empathy, you know, see the world from somebody else's perspective. And these are religious spiritual values for me that then get put into play in a social justice struggle or in a context of promoting more equality. So like one of my idols, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, said when he was marching in the civil rights movement, he was praying with his feet. And that's certainly a touchstone for me.
Jay, you added fatherhood to your complicated job description a couple of years ago. Talk about how that changed the juggling act that you'd been performing.
Well, no more meditation retreats, that's for sure. a lot of the book, Enlightenment by Trial and Error, a lot of it's either relating to extended periods of meditation. So my longest one was spending 5 months in silence. That was in 2008, 2009. Now I'd be lucky to get 5 minutes. So that's really shifted. But that's fine. I feel like, you know, it's not, maybe not forever, but it certainly, the zone or the place of my spiritual practice has shifted to things which may be more familiar to more folks, you know, patience and forbearance and showing up for my daughter and who's now 2 years old. And it's fun being older dads. My partner's 52 and I'm 48. So it's unusual to have a 2 year old at that age, I guess, although maybe less unusual than it once was. But I feel really fortunate to have some of the tools that I've developed over the years, just basic garden variety mindfulness, nothing fancy or esoteric, but just being able to see how I feel at a particular moment. Oh, I'm feeling angry right now. Let's be careful and not speak, not give that voice the microphone. So very kind of basic stuff is now at the forefront of my spiritual practice. And that's convenient because that's also, look, again, in my work at 10% Happier, that's where people are. So they're not so interested in hearing about what I write in the book, you know, profound absorptive states of ecstatic union with God. I mean, that stuff's nice, but, you know, I got a crying toddler over here. So maybe you can help me out with that. And that's been a real, I saw it coming. And I, you know, I was very intentional about that. It hasn't taken me by surprise, but I will say, you know, a lot of my early parenting experience has really tracked a lot of cliches, like a lot of stuff that all parents of young children say. One of them being that political cliche about what kind of world we're leaving for our children. It just feels very much more real than it did before. And again, I'm not the first person to say that or the millionth person to say that, but there is a profound sadness that I sometimes feel about what world my daughter may inherit. And it motivates a lot of my current political work, which is more on the side of being a journalist and writing, trying to shed light on some of what's happening in the world. But it's very real for me.
On this journey, I know you've added skills and areas of focus. What have you chosen to let go? What did you put down because it grew too heavy to carry along this path?
My commitment to legal normative Judaism. Part two of the book, which is subtitled Unraveling, is really about letting go of what was kind of an Orthodox style Jewish practice. So among practicing religious Jews, one of the defining questions is one's relationship to Jewish law, Jewish tradition, how binding one believes that law to be or chooses to take on that responsibility. And that could be a little different, let's say, from questions of faith or of belief. They're mostly questions of practice. And I was pretty traditional in my Jewish practice at the beginning of the book, in 2001. But by 2010, which is sort of the end of the period of that's covered by the book, I really wasn't. And sometimes that was a difficult process of letting go. There was some angst around it that I talk about in the book. But where I sit now, you know, I treasure some of the, let's say, the Jewish folkways and religion and orientation toward justice and activism. And I love the Jewishness that my family practices today, but it's certainly less traditional than it was 15 years ago. And that can be really challenging.
You know, Jay, I am often at a loss these days for a way to see anything but ever deepening divisions in our world. Are there levels at which you are able to see actual growth and even enlightenment that could still come to the fore in time?
I actually am a midterm optimist, meaning short term, you know, we're in 2020 and who knows what this election will be. I think the best current example that I can give you is the Super Bowl halftime show, right? And this was, you know, Shakira and Jennifer Lopez, two women of color, one Latina, the other mixed heritage Latina, also Lebanese, and a Puerto Rican hip hop artist, Bad Bunny, bringing their full cultural selves to this center of American popular culture, right? There's nothing more America, I think, than the Super Bowl halftime show or the Super Bowl itself. And this is not the Donald Trump America, right? This is an America that's shifting and growing and changing, that's diverse, that's multicultural. And it reflects that halftime show. Part of it was the NFL trying to fix their own very spotty record on race and gender. But part of it was also a reflection of where we are as a country. And I really think, first of all, you know, as a gay man, it was just a great performance. It was like an amazing thing to watch these two divas do their thing in such a sort of spectacular way. But it also gave me a lot of hope and reminded me of what world we're really living in. You know, the most ardent populist sort of racist folks on the right, they're not wrong. They're right that America is changing. They're wrong about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I think they're profoundly morally wrong. But they're not wrong about the facts that a certain kind of America where a certain group had dominance and set the tone and other groups had to take a back seat, that is ending. And so conservative folks in this country are doing their best to slow that process down with voter suppression and making it harder and harder for people of color to vote, particularly in states like Texas and North Carolina. But you can't stop the clock, and I don't think you can turn it back either. So I actually have a certain kind of optimism around the changing of America. And I also, you know, I think it is a troubling moment of drifting apart and bifurcation in our spiritual lives, where the sort of conservative religious right is growing stronger, and the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, people who affiliate with no particular religious tradition are growing larger, and the center does seem to be falling out. The sort of liberal religious center that used to be really predominant in American public life is changing. But I have a lot of faith in the nuns. The spiritual but not religious are people who are curious and questing and looking for profound answers, not just the simple stuff. And they're the people who I hope might somehow discover my book.
Was there something you know now that you wish the you of 10 years ago would have known?
There are a couple of chapters in the book that are about either politics or social justice. I think what we talked about earlier, the integration of those two sides, was not as clear in the book as I'd make it if I were writing that book again now. There seemed to be more of a distinction between my solitary spiritual practice and everything else. And I don't see those as separate now as I did then. And I think there was, you know, a fair amount of fear early on of the dropping away of some certain kinds of boundaries and how far is too far and what's right for me and what's the path for me. And a lot of that was just being younger. But some of that was just being earlier on the path. There's a sort of confidence that's built up over the years that, you know, again, part of the reason I put this book out was that it wasn't there. And I think it's valuable to people who are considering starting out a sort of more serious contemplative practice to see that and to see that doubt. But it was difficult at the time. You know, now I think there'd be a bit more confidence in trusting the wisdom of the heart and integrating that wisdom with the challenges that we face.
The journey always starts with a single step. Say someone hearing this right now finds what you're saying is something they find relatable as they listen. They're going to get your book. But beyond that, what single step would you suggest for moving toward balance of the personal, political, and spiritual?
Buying another of my books. I think I am an evangelist for meditation and mindfulness in whatever context, whether it's religious or secular or spiritual. And I think it's possible to take those first steps. And it doesn't have to be meditation specifically. It could be centering prayer, for example, or it could just be bringing some silence into one's daily life, or just doing acts of loving kindness in a very intentional way and being present for those. Whatever it looks like, though, I think it's possible. And what I love about my work life now, where I spend so much time trying to make these teachings accessible to a much wider audience. You know, the 10% Happier weekly email that I edit goes out to 750,000 people for free. And I love that opportunity. And I'm really convinced that those first small steps that you mentioned along some contemplative path, making some choice to whether it's meditation or something or anything else, just making that choice to just give a couple of minutes a day or a week, or if you have the freedom in your schedule to devote a day or two, you know, to more intensive kind of spiritual work, I actually think those can, you'll see rewards very quickly. The rewards deepen the more serious and intense the practice gets. But even just those first steps, so I don't want to self-promote just where I work at 10% Happier, but whatever those first steps are, whether it's at your church or place of worship, or your yoga class, or you're walking in the woods, but really taking proactive steps to make the development of the mind and heart a part of your life project.
Dr. J. Michelson is an author, activist, attorney, and a rabbi who has written on wildly disparate topics in a constantly insightful and articulate way. His latest book is Enlightenment by Trial and Error, 10 Years on the Slippery Slopes of Jewish Spirituality, Postmodern Buddhism, and Other Mystical Heresies. And while not strictly a memoir, it certainly is an invaluable record of a journey far more of us contemplate than ever undertake. Jay, I have to say, the phrase enlightenment by trial and error may be the single most liberating expression we are likely to feature on this show for a long time, and I want to say thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
It's truly always a pleasure, and I look forward to our next opportunity.
In 2009, we had not yet seen an American president pander to the political religious right in as transparent a way as does Donald Trump. We had also not yet seen that bloc pledge such unblinking devotion to a secular figure in return. What we had seen is a long history of American presidents invoke their own values in religious terms, including Barack Obama, who always embraced people of all faiths and of no faith in his oratory. Many decades earlier, another U.S. president showed both skill and integrity in sounding themes that resonated with people of faith without alienating or marginalizing anyone else. In 2009, I conducted an interview with Abraham Lincoln historian Ronald C. White, Jr. that seems fitting to revisit on this President's Day weekend.
Thank you very much.
Abraham Lincoln's parents were Baptists, I understand. I came out of that tradition myself. And then later, his wife Mary had family ties to both the Episcopalian and Presbyterian churches. But as I understand it, Lincoln never officially joined a church. How does that all fit together?
Well, Lincoln did not join a church. His mother and then stepmother, father, and sister all were members of what in those days was called a separate Baptist church.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been unusual that the fourth member of the family, Abraham the boy, did not join. Although it wasn't all that unusual in the 19th century, we need to remember that becoming a member of the church then demanded much more than it does today.
Mm-hmm.
People needed to give a narration or a narrative of their faith or their faith experience. But Lincoln, as not too untypical of young people, kind of pushed against the faith of his parents, as he pushed against his father, particularly about learning and about farming, and became a scoffer, if not a skeptic. And then I argue the story that's often forgotten is that later in life, under the stress of the death of his son Willie and certainly the Civil War, he reappropriated elements of the Christian faith.
Is that reflected in the amount of references he makes to Scripture and his use of religious imagery, or was that always true in his speech writing?
Well, it's true in his speech writing, but it grows, and we have multiple witnesses of his use and reading of the Bible, for example, as president.
Hmm.
And there's multiple witnesses of people seeing him in the White House and how he would read the Bible. He would read it to the point that he memorized. He loved the Psalms, and he would memorize whole Psalms.
So from your perspective, his use of the Bible and his use of religious imagery came not just because he was trying to appeal to religious people for political reasons, but because the religious also had appeal to him.
Absolutely. And if I may, let me just read just a few sentences from this note that he wrote,
sure,
his eyes only, found after his death.
That would be good.
He had a habit of writing things out on small scraps of paper to define his own thinking. This scrap of paper was found only after his death. He didn't title it. His young secretary found it and gave it the title, The Meditation on the Divine Will. The will of God prevails. In great contests, each party claims to act in accordance with the will of God. Both may be, and one must be, wrong. God cannot be for and against the same thing at the same time. In the present civil war, it is quite possible that God's purpose is something different from the purpose of either party, and yet the human instrumentalities, working just as they do, are of the best adaptation to effect his purpose. I believe that people of Christian faith will hear in these words not someone simply musing philosophically, but at a very deep level asking himself the question, what is the purpose of God? Again and again, he uses the subject and predicate, God wills, God wills.
Mm-hmm.
This is no fatalist. This is no deist.
Mm-hmm.
He is speaking of a providential God who acts in history.
Ronald, does that mean, in your mind, that Lincoln saw the war as a part of God's plan?
It does. I mean, at the end of this thing, he says, I'm almost ready to say this is probably true, that God wills this contest and wills that it shall not end yet. By his mere great power on the minds of the now contestants, he could have either just saved or destroyed the Union without a human contest. Yet the contest began. Lincoln is humbled before the majesty of God, whom he always called the Almighty or the living God. His posture, unusual in that time in a Presbyterian congregation in Washington. People noted this when the minister said, now it's time to pray. Lincoln stood up to pray. And people said, why are you? He said, because I'm standing up out of my respect to the Almighty.
Here's a somewhat of a funny question, but there are some websites, I'm sure you know, dedicated to trying to prove that Abraham Lincoln was actually Jewish. They cite Lincoln's name as evidence that he had a sister named Sarah, a great-grandfather named Mordecai. They point out that Lincoln's family came from a town in England that had a large Jewish population. Have you heard that before, and how do you respond to that?
I guess I don't read the right website. One of the things I'm trying to do in my book is to suggest that although Lincoln presented himself as well he wanted to as a self-made man, and that it's so said that he did not care to find out about his ancestry. Actually, if he could have found out everything, the first Lincoln came from near Norwich, England, was part of a Puritan congregation in Massachusetts, helped build the church, and that all of those names, of course, are biblical names, mm-hmm. and not at all unusual that people of the Christian faith would name their children after biblical characters of the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. His grandfather was named Abraham. His sister was named Sarah.
Goodness. Ronald C. White, Jr. is the author of the new book, A. Lincoln, A Biography. Ronald, thanks so much for speaking with me on State of Belief.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say a sincere thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And do you know someone who you think might benefit from hearing what you're hearing? Please commit to sharing State of Belief with just one person this week. Do it on social media or in person. It's incredibly helpful to know that we are reaching more and more people, especially at a time such as this. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform, and take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.